Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a discussion about who is winning the debt debate. Lawrence Jacobs, Director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota, joins us to assess who is winning from the political brinkmanship in Washington that has our already weak economy being held hostage to a threat of economic collapse unless political demands are met. Then we'll examine further the two Americas, the 99% majority of us who are trying to get by and the 1% of millionaires and billionaires whose privileges the Republicans are prepared to fight to the bitter end to protect, even if it means destroying the economy. Sam Pizzagatti joins us to talk about whether our democracy has become a plutocracy. He is the author of the online newsletter Too Much and has an article at alternet.com. Plutocracy. If corporations and the rich paid 1960s level taxes, the debt would vanish. Then we'll hear from John Hanrahan, the former executive director of the Fund for Investigative Journalism, with an environmental activist just being sentenced to 2 years in jail for protesting global warming. We'll discuss John's article on the Nieman watchdog, at least 1,400 arrests for anti-war dissent, but who's counting? Not the press. Then finally, Larry Beinhart joins us. He wrote Wag the Dog, that became a classic movie, and Salvation Boulevard, just out in paperback, with a movie version of it in the theaters. We'll talk about religious intolerance that leads to violence, a subject in the news, and the subtext of Salvation Boulevard, a thriller in which a born-again Christian private's faith is shaken to the core when he takes the case of a Muslim student suspected of killing his atheist professor. Joining us now is Lawrence Jacobs, who's the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair for Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include The Unsustainable American State, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America and the Search for Community, and Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. He has an article out now on CNN.com called Who's Winning the Debt Debate? Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be with you.
Could you answer that question, who's winning the debt debate?
I would say the Republicans are losing it. You look at the polls and it shows that there's almost 6 out of 10 Americans who would like to see a combination of spending cuts and some kind of new revenue coming in. And that includes 65% of the swing voters among independents. So it seems to be a pretty decisive verdict at this point against Republicans.
Well, my feeling, though, is, Lawrence Jacobs, that those figures would be even more in the Democrats' favor if we didn't have this convention in the American press for the so-called balance, the pro-con arguments, and then the thesis, antithesis, synthesis. The idea that everything is equal and opposite. In the universe of discourse, everything is black and white. And frankly, to me, there is no proportionality in this debate. It is clear that one side is threatening the full faith and credit of the United States. They're threatening to destroy that if they don't get 100% of their way. And I think that because of this press convention, people are getting both sides of it, which, frankly, there aren't both sides of this. This is pure extortion.
Well, I think you're right and wrong at the same time. I don't think that the media can be blamed for this alone. After all, we just had President Obama on national television stating what he's been stating publicly for several weeks now, that he favors an approach that would include both spending cuts and some kind of new revenue, and that he welcomes the effort, including from Speaker Boehner in the House, to build that sort of kind of more moderate centrist approach. But you're right that Americans are pretty harsh in their views about how Republicans are behaving. There's been a growing number now up above 60% who say that the Republicans are behaving irresponsibly with regard to the debt ceiling, while a majority, a small majority, give Democrats credit for acting responsibly. So I think the Americans are getting what's going on in Washington, and part of this balancing is, frankly, part of what President Obama's been up to.
Well, but Lawrence Jacobs, this has never happened before. This has been a routine thing, this debt ceiling that Republicans and Democratic presidents alike have routinely passed. You know, obviously we know that Senator Obama voted against it, but it's never become an issue until the Republicans decided to make it an issue. So surely this is a deliberate act on their part to essentially hold hostage the economy of the United States and by extension the world.
And I think the Republicans are taking a beating for it in the court of public opinion. you know, you kind of look out to the 2012 election, and if the economy continues to struggle, it's a good chance Barack Obama could well lose his reelection battle. But if the Republicans continue on this course, where they are acting in a way that Americans see as irresponsible and don't trust them on a whole lot of issues, including Medicare, then they may actually snatch defeat from the mouth of victory.
So do you think, though, that, I mean, we don't know where this showdown is heading. A lot of talk now about the president invoking the 14th Amendment, and I assume that that's becoming more and more likely. It would, of course, result in an immediate challenge, and it's hard to know how quickly it would get to the Supreme Court and how this very conservative Supreme Court would rule on that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's something that President Obama has got to be very careful with. The key thing to remember on these prerogative imperial powers exercised by presidents is you can have a president who may be entirely well-meaning in exercising those powers, and this may be that situation, but they can be used for very different means sometime down the road. We had an experience with that with Richard Nixon, who had used the prerogatives of the presidency that had been building up over Democratic and Republican administrations to engage in things like an extensive cover-up of his role in the Watergate break-in and other sorts of areas of illegality or unconstitutional conduct. So I think this is a very grave step, and I think it's been pretty clear all along that the White House would much prefer to have the normal legislative process work, and politically, it would ensure that Republicans were on board with the solution rather than the president alone taking this extraordinary action and then being the sole holder of the blame and the uproar that will result.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who's the director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota. He has an article out on CNN.com called Who's Winning the Debt Debate? But of course, the easier said than done, surely, Lawrence Jacobs. So far, there's no indication that there's any flexibility, and it seems that every time Boehner makes any kind of agreement with the president behind closed doors, he has to repudiate it the minute he gets back and gets screamed at by the Tea Party caucus. And now his own bill now has to be redrawn. And the president's already saying he's going to veto that. So what leads you to think that there may be a legislative solution before Obama has to invoke the 14th Amendment?
If you think about this as a baseball game with nine innings, we're somewhere near the top of the seventh inning. There is a whole lot of time left, and there will be two to three different developments between now and Monday. And we may actually even have a bit more time after August 2nd. So I think there's going to be quite a bit of action in the legislature. I think Speaker Boehner will pass something, then we'll see a counterproposal from the Senate Democrats and the leader there, Harry Reid, and it'll go back and forth. So we're far from the end of this. This will be, I think, you know, a nail-biter. The stakes are obviously very high, and the country is already suffering, I think, some significant costs. But I do think that the Congress and the president will be able to work things out.
Well, when you say, Lawrence Jacob, the country is suffering from a cost, I would think that already the signal that's being sent to the global markets about the U.S. economy is, in effect, don't buy our tea bill. Now, maybe the Tea Party fundamentalists don't care. In fact, that may well be their agenda, not to borrow anymore. But in the real world, it would seem to me that a default would be a catastrophe, but even a threat of default seems to have rattled the global markets.
Well, we're seeing that already in the last couple of days. The stock market has taken, you know, not a steep nosedive, but certainly it's going down sharply. And we may well start to see interest rates going up, U.S. treasuries, but also on interest rates for businesses. So we will feel the cost of this, I think, for some time. And it won't be just on the default option. It'll be kind of on a close call, because we're going to find that the credit rating agencies are going to downgrade the certainty of being repaid by the United States of America. This is really quite extraordinary.
Well, but surely, just in terms of where we are as an economy, and obviously economics have been overwhelmed by politics, but the economic reality is that we're still trying to recover from a recession. We have huge unemployment. We have a lot of uncertainty, meaning that the banks and corporate America are sitting on a lot of money that they're not prepared to invest. And all of this is a millstone around the president and the Democrats' neck. So how cynical can one be about this? That, you know, when you have people like Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, saying his number one priority is to just defeat Obama and make sure he doesn't get a second term, has the economy become a part of that strategy?
Well, I think the Republicans are not doing as much as they might to boost the economy. And I think if you had a Republican president, and you probably see the tax cuts that President Obama and Democrats have been talking about, you would have seen those approved. But let's be clear. What is going on right now with the battle over the debt limit is extraordinary. And it is something that Republican leaders, including Mitch McConnell in the Senate, and the closest business allies to the Republican Party are alarmed about and see as very much against their own interests. As I mentioned before, you've got 63% of Americans now thinking that the Republican Party can't be trusted to manage our debt. That is just a very bad situation, and I think the smart heads in the Republican Party might well have some confidence that they could win the 2012 presidential election, except if the party becomes defined as irresponsible and unable to manage the economy.
And in terms of the internal wranglings amongst Republicans, who would you suggest has the ascendancy here? Because it would seem to me the dividing line is between the kind of Tea Party libertarian wing funded by the Koch brothers and others, and then the more traditional Republican, Main Street Republicans, who are obviously getting a lot of phone calls from corporate America, right?
Yeah, I think that is the split. I think there's a kind of the traditional business wing of the Republican Party that used to be the dominant wing, and this insurgency that's partly libertarian, it's also partly, frankly, isolationist. And what I hear in some of the opposition to raising the debt limit is unwillingness to participate in the international financial markets. Now, I think those of us who know something about that realize that is a very dangerous game to play, because these markets have no friends, they have no country, and if they turn on the United States, every American will suffer.
But if that happens, won't that be a Pyrrhic victory for the president? The Republicans will be blamed in the short term, but he'll be running on a devastated economy in 2012, and people have short memories.
Well, I think that's too cynical. I think this sort of thing will be kind of a branding opportunity for the Republican Party. If you want to go back to the Great Depression, I think most people will think of it as the Hoover Depression. If the Republican Party holds up and blocks a raising of a debt limit, and then the country as a result goes into a steep economic decline and a double dip on the recession, that will hurt them tremendously, much more so than the president. I think at this point, the Republicans' best shot for winning the White House is to stay out of the way and not be seen as literally putting their fingerprints on economic decline. They want the president to take that blame. But as we're seeing in many, many polls that are coming out in the last few days, the Republicans are actually starting to be blamed for the fiscal condition of the country and for being seen as obstinate and threatening the country's well-being. That is, from a Republican point of view, a very bad spot to be in.
And Lawrence Jacobs, do you think that the central argument that the president made in his recent speech, which was followed then by Boehner's speech, and they, again, to my mind, they were kind of given equal time, but an equal emphasis by the press. But that aside, do you think that the central argument about economic fairness, about the disparity of wealth, the growing disparity of wealth in this country, the notion that the middle class and the working Americans are bearing the brunt, and that the wealthy, the millionaires and billionaires, who the Tea Party caucus seem to be zealously protecting the prerogatives of these people who have done so well over the last decades, do you think that's resonating?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're seeing quite a bit of support among Americans for the kind of approach the president's talked about, taking away some of the tax break for the super rich hedge fund managers, looking to take away tax credits for, say, private jets for business, and on down the list. I mean, this is a very effective line of argument, and certainly at a time when so many Americans are out of work and struggling to pay their bills, the Republicans find themselves on the wrong side of the argument here and are very much being identified with defending the rich. And I think the president is pretty effective in that argument. There are other parts of that speech I thought were not as effective, though.
Like what?
Well, I thought his emphasis on the dysfunction of government and the need for extensive cuts, including in Social Security and Medicare, gave away a lot of ground. And it's not clear that he gets much help from that in a bargaining situation. You go back and you look at the way Ronald Reagan used to bargain with a Democratic Congress. He gave no ground at all. He took a very strong position and then fight it out. And at the end of the day, then he would, cut a deal. This president seems to like to make the concessions up front and then engage in bargaining. And that's just not, a very effective approach.
Well, the rationale for that, of course, is that he's trying to reach out to the center and look like the only adult in the room. But do you think that reaching out to the center is mutually exclusive in terms of alienating the progressives and the left, who are already pretty jaundiced about this administration?
The left and progressives at the end of the day, will vote for Barack Obama. And I think what's going on in the House of Representatives is, or should be, instructional as to what would happen if Obama's not reelected in terms of their perspective. But I think independence can be approached in a lot of ways. But I think, you know, playing up the dysfunction of government doesn't really help the president's hand when he's trying to defend government, particularly in the areas of Social Security and Medicare. He's undermining his own case.
Well, I thank you for joining us. And I think a lot of people feel that way and wonder why all of this stuff has been put on the table. And even if it's, I suppose, in many ways, the worst thing that could happen is the Republicans suddenly gain some sanity and accept these generous offers from him.
Well, this is what a lot of longtime Republican conservatives have been saying, particularly the deal that John Boehner apparently had cut with the president was going to have about four times more cuts than new revenue, including cuts in Social Security and Medicare. That would have been a landmark and could have been seen by progressives or liberals as a big setback. But the right wing of the Republican Party scuttled it. And there are, again, the veteran Republican conservatives who feel like that was a big mistake, that they had a tremendous win there and should have taken it.
But it leaves progressives wondering how this president feels about the very pillars of the Democratic Party and its legacy.
This is a complicated president. I think he has, in some respects, quite accommodative of Republicans, but also of the business sector. But I think when you look at the health reform, and particularly its really quite significant redistributive features, the financial reform and the new regulatory structure it creates, and the new approach that he's creating towards direct lending for higher education, he may well be the most progressive president since Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1930s.
So you said he's the most progressive president?
Yeah. I mean, again, just take a look at health reform alone. It's,
right.
It's a remarkable piece of legislation. I know there are a lot of progressives and liberals who, wish for a single-payer system.
Mm-hmm.
But that was never going to happen. It was not even close to happening because the votes weren't there in Congress. But the legislation he did pass puts a variety of new taxes on the affluent and on affluent businesses and health care providers, and it takes that money and it shifts it over to tens of millions of Americans who either lacked health insurance or had pretty inferior health insurance and medical coverage.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying here is that the president maybe talks right but governs left.
You know, if you look at the history of social welfare reform in America and frankly in other countries, it's always come with accommodation of stakeholders. And I think that's what Barack Obama has done. And he's also responded to the conditions on the ground when he's in office. And right now we have one of the most conservative ruling coalitions, United States House of Representatives, in a long time.
Well, I thank you for the conversation. And it's been very interesting. Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be with you. Take care.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who's the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. He has an article out on CNN.com called Who's Winning the Debt Debate? We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment.
I look at life from both sides now, from win and lose, and still somehow it's life's illusion. I recall, I really don't know life at all.
Tell me, who's that? Who's that?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Sam Pizzagatti, who's a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He is an editor at the online newsletter Too Much. He currently has an article out at alternet.org titled Plutocracy. If corporations and the rich paid 1960s level taxes, the debt would vanish. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Pizzagatti.
Thank you, Ian.
And in terms of the title of your article at alternet.org, corporations, if plutocracy of corporations and the rich paid 1960s level taxes, the debt would vanish. Frankly, a lot of people would just settle for going back to the Clinton era, but even that's too much for them.
Well, that's very true. Right now, the Clinton, going back to the Clinton era, is regarded as the most radical possible thing that we could ever do, which of course is crazy, because a generation ago, Clinton era tax rates would have been considered incredibly friendly to the rich. And now those rates are considered the most radical thing we can do. It's just amazing the conversion in our political thinking over the past generation.
Well, we just got through talking about the president's recent speech, where he singled out the fealty that the Republicans have towards the millionaires and billionaires, and clearly they're prepared to bring the whole house down unless the millionaires and billionaires are protected and their privileges are protected. So polling indicates that the American people actually are concerned about the disparity in wealth, and they do fear that this gets to the heart of the American dream, and whether or not this country still is the meritocracy that we all believe it is, you know, the Horatio Alger meritocracy. So you're saying no, that the plutocrats have got the game sewn up, right?
Well, they certainly think they do, and lawmakers in Congress are certainly acting as if they had the game locked up. The debt crisis, the debate that we're seeing right now here in Washington, D.C., is incredibly one-sided. All the options that are on the table right now, all of them are going to rebound to the credit of the rich and powerful in the United States. Whatever happens, given the options now, rich people are not going to be paying one penny more in taxes, and that's just incredible. If I could just give you just one set of numbers. Both Harry Reid, the Democrat from Nevada in the Senate, and John Boehner, the Republican House Speaker, both of them are now talking about $1.2 trillion in cuts over the next 10 years, cuts in programs that help average Americans get by. If we taxed Americans who make $1 million or more at the rates that we taxed them back in 1961, we would raise $2.3 trillion, over almost twice as much as Harry Reid and John Boehner agree has to be cut over out of the budget over the next 10 years.
So as you have written recently, Sam Pizzicati, that our political system is failing to tax the rich because the rich have fortunes large enough to buy off the political system. And we know that the Supreme Court has, in fact, cemented that opportunity in perpetuity through its Citizens United decision, giving corporations the unlimited ability to spend money. And it's equally offered to unions, but there's no parity there. And it's led to these, because there's no transparency, it's led to all these front groups, which will be very active in the next year and a half as we get to the 2012 elections. And we saw from the 2010 elections how effective that spending was. So we have obviously reached a point in this country where the power of money is greater than the power of votes.
That's absolutely true. And again, I think it's useful to do some historical comparisons. In 2007, which is the most recent year that we have statistics for, the richest 400 Americans averaged $270 million each in income. And they only paid 16% of that in taxes. If we go back in time, if we go back to 1955, the middle of the Eisenhower years, remember Dwight Eisenhower's Republican president, in 1955, the richest 400 in today's dollars, that is after adjusting for inflation, they only made $13.3 million each on average. So $13.3 million for the top 400 in 1955, $170 million in 2007. And back in 1955, they paid 51.2% of that $13.3 million in federal income tax. So in other words, they paid a tax rate three times as much on an income that was 20 times smaller. So those rich back then, America's plutocrats back then, were very feeble plutocrats. After taxes, they didn't have much money left to influence the political process. Today's top 400, if you tax them at 1955 rates, they'd have $40 billion less in their pockets to spend on influencing the political system. That's an enormous, enormous difference.
So you would think, though, that the people who are being affected by this unfairness, and that's the 99% of us, or let's say 98% of us, you would think that they'd be more politically active. The statistics indicate the opposite. In 2008, when Obama was swept in and the Democrats got a huge majority, 140 million voted. Just 2 years later, half of that, 75 million voted. And that led to the election of these zealots who are now creating this economic hostage crisis. And the demoralized left in this country just seems to be so fickle, and I don't see that they're going to come back. They ought to be able to see what will happen in 2012 if more of these Tea Party people and a president like them takes over. But do you have the confidence that there is some kind of Pavlovian mechanism at work here where people will wake up when the pain becomes intense?
Well, I think what happened in the last general election is that 2 years earlier, people had voted for change, and they didn't see change. And I think there was a lot of frustration out there, and the election results reflected that frustration. But to the question, you know, will people wake up? Well, I think back to the 1920s. 1920s were a time very much like our own, with great, huge amounts of wealth concentrated at the top. At the end of the 1920s, we had a Great Depression, in the same way we've had the Great Recession. In the early years of the Great Depression, 1930, 1931, people were despairing. It was very much like today. It looked like the rich had come through the Great Depression, the stock market crash, with their flyer colors flying. But yet, in the span of just two more years, by 1934, 1935, the country was in revolt on all sorts of fronts, in farms and factories, and things changed very rapidly. Things can turn around really almost on a dime. So do I have confidence that the people can wake up? Yes, I do, because history has shown that turnarounds can happen very suddenly.
Well, Sam Pizzicati, I thank you for joining us. I thank you for your optimism. It's very soothing to hear in these dismal times. Again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sam Pizzicati, a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He is the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and he currently has an article out on alternet.org titled Plutocracy. If corporations and the rich paid 1960s level taxes, the debt would vanish. Let's now turn to ask, why isn't the press covering anti-war dissent? Joining us now is John Hanrahan, a former executive director of the Fund for Investigative Journalism and reporter for The Washington Post, The Washington Star, UPI, and other news organizations. Until recently a legal investigator, John Hanrahan is the author of Lost Frontier, The Marketing of Alaska and Government by Contract. He is now on a special assignment for the press monitoring organization Nieman Watchdog, where he currently has an article called At Least 1,400 Arrests for Anti-War Dissent, But Who's Counting? Not the Press. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Hanrahan.
Yes, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Just before I get into the press not caring, focusing on this story of the arrests in this country for anti-war protests, what's your attitude to criticism of people like Paul Krugman about how the big story of the moment, the economic hostage crisis in Washington, D.C., is being covered? He argues, Krugman, is that because of this balance in the media of having the pro and con arguments on an equal footing, that the people in this country are not getting an accurate picture of what's really happening, where it's clear that one side is threatening to destroy the economy unless they get everything that they want.
Yeah, no, I saw that column, and that's certainly in this case and in so many other cases, this sort of false equivalency, this notion that, and this is not to say that the Democrats are on the right, you know, correct path in this, because they seem to capitulate to the Republican lunacy. But I think that's absolutely right, that too often there's this sort of a false equivalency. We've got to have things balanced, even if something's demonstrably untrue or just complete fantasy. I even go back to the so-called debate over torture in this country, where once upon a time you would have said, well, there'd be no debate on this, but suddenly it became a debate, which just certainly appalling to me as a former journalist, and the whole notion of, you know, not ever referring to it as torture, but as enhanced interrogation. So the press treats some of these really fantasy statements of many of the politicians here as if they deserve some credence, as if they counterbalance something on the other side.
Well, let's turn to the story that you've written here about the 1,400 arrests for anti-war dissent here in the United States that the media have been ignoring. It's hard to ignore the fact that an environmental activist, Tim DeChristopher, was just sentenced to 2 years in prison and a $10,000 fine for presenting phony bids at an auction, which was authorized under the Bush administration. And subsequently, these leases were then canceled, or these parcels were then canceled by the current Secretary of the Interior, Salazar. And he argues, of course, that he was trying to save the environment and stop global warming. But it was treated as a criminal matter. Would that, you think, fits into what you've been writing about?
Yeah, I think, it definitely does, probably in that case, and I actually haven't monitored, you know, to see what how the press has covered it, because a lot of the information I was getting on it was from some of the groups supporting him. I know that at least, you know, the mainstream media, I'm fairly certain, would do some coverage of that, but probably not going into his motives for doing it, which I think are probably key here. But it certainly does fit into the types of stories that I'm talking about. And as you suggest with the question, and as I mentioned in one of the two articles I've done on the press coverage of the anti-war movement, it's certainly not just the anti-war movement that doesn't get covered, but it's all kinds of other causes related to the economy, the job situation, the banks, et cetera. There have been big demonstrations in that front, too, that haven't been covered. But yeah, I mean, to me, this would fit into, I believe he argued, I saw part of his statement today pretty eloquently, that this was an act of civil disobedience, and that's how I interpreted it from the beginning also.
But in terms of the broader issue of why the media is not covering anti-war activists, 1,400 of whom have been arrested this year, your feeling is that this actually helps contribute to continuing military involvement in the case of Afghanistan, which is a clearly unpopular war that...
Yeah, I mean, in the sense that I think people, and there's so many people, of course, today, particularly younger people, are more plugged into the Internet, but a lot of us older folks rely more on newspapers, and it used to be that even to a certain extent to television news, and that there is some sort of, you know, when you see it reinforced in the mainstream media, you say, I guess that, you know, I'm not alone in this. But if you read the mainstream media, you would not get the sense that there is still a lot of protest, and not all of it that results in arrests, as I think I point out in one of the two articles I did on this. There's a lot of other activity that, you know, whether it's teach-ins or vigils. Walter Reed Hospital here, there's been a vigil every Friday night for 7 years, 8 years, and, you know, that doesn't get covered. Not that every little demonstration should get covered, I mean, because I understand you can't be everywhere at once, but the press has just missed so many what I would consider big newsworthy stories, even if you weren't sympathetic to them as I am. Just looking at them from the standpoint of a journalist, you'd say, what is news? And to me, it's news. One of the stories I referenced in one of the two articles I did, when, you know, 130 people get arrested at the White House last December in a snowstorm. These were people, as I said, even if you didn't care about the anti-war movement, you'd say, well, look, these are a lot of fairly prominent people. You have Daniel Ellsberg being arrested. You have a Pulitzer Prize winner, evening journalist, Chris Hedges getting arrested. You have a respected FBI whistleblower, Colleen Rowley, getting arrested. Somebody who used to give briefings to the President of the United States for the CIA, the CIA analyst, Ray McGovern. And they got the Post, in that case, got a lot of complaints that they hadn't covered this big rally. That was the most people that had been arrested at the White House all year for any reason, by far. And the Post ombudsman even said, sort of took the paper to fault, but said, well, you know, these are all prearranged arrests, well, which they weren't, but nevertheless, they just don't cover them. And as I said, these have newsworthy elements in them, and besides having a strong message.
Well, that indicates to me, and something that I've detected in journalism, and in this case, it was the editors of the Washington Post you're referring to, but isn't there a sort of somewhat a cynical contempt for activists, political activists, that amongst journalists who like to sort of see themselves as the piano player in the whorehouse, and they want to dampen down any kind of personal passions and feelings and be neutral,
yeah,
and they kind
yeah,
of think these people that are out there are just a bunch of crazy ideologues. And
I am so glad you asked that question. And my, you know, my inside information and some of these news organizations is way in the past. But the attitude generally, and I don't want to pick on the Washington Post only, but the attitude generally when I was there was activists of any sort. They could be, you know, a civic activist who's fighting over a zoning issue or something, or it could be an anti-war protester. But it was sort of the feeling that they were a pain in the ass. I mean, that was generally the response, that, you know, oh, there go those people again doing that. Oh, my God, isn't that so like the 1960s or something? I mean, you know, I'm sort of mind-reading here, too, but I don't know what else to infer from this lack of coverage other than they're really not worth covering. The Tea Party, on the other hand, could have, you know, smaller rallies here in D.C. and in other parts of the country, and for a while they were very much in vogue with the press. Anything they did seemed to be worthy of coverage, no matter how off the charts it was. So, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I can't read people's minds, but I can only infer that they just really think these are people that are out on the fringe and not worth covering.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, John Hanrahan.
I thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with John Hanrahan, former executive director of the Fund for Investigative Journalism and reporter for The Washington Post, The Washington Star, UPI, and other news organizations. Until recently, he was a legal investigator, and he's the author of Lost Frontier, The Marketing of Alaska and Government by Contract. He is now on special assignment for the press monitoring organization Nieman Watchdog, where he currently has an article called At Least 1,400 Arrests for Anti-War Dissent, But Who's Counting? Not the press. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Larry Beinhart. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm now joined by Larry Beinhart, who is an award-winning novelist and the author of Salvation Boulevard, just out in paperback. The movie based on this book is now in theaters. His other books include Fog Facts, Searching for the Truth in the Land of Spin, and The Librarian, and Wag the Dog, which was made into a classic film. Welcome to Background Briefing, Larry Beinhart. Are you there, Larry?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Excellent.
So clearly, we've just witnessed some of the most horrific political violence that was a result of religious intolerance and I think probably a large measure of madness as well. But have you been following the repercussions here from the manifesto that this mass murderer wrote, where he cites a bunch of American bloggers, Muslim-bashing bloggers?
I mean, clearly, you know, if we're going to follow Bush doctrine, the Norwegians, you know, should follow terrorists and invade the countries that harbor them. So, you know, I would expect the Norwegian fleet to show up at our doorstep any minute.
Well, that was one of the clearly, though, the dysfunctional war on terrorism that George Bush launched. First of all, it elevated bin Laden as an equal...
Launched and lost.
Yes, well, I'm going to say he lost from day one because he elevated bin Laden as an equal player on the world stage, compared him to Hitler. And the irony that I find in relationship to this Muslim bashing going on in this country is that if there were such a thing as a war on terror, a war against Islamic extremists, the only people who could win that war would be Islamic moderates who could moderate the extremists.
Something like that, you know. But I think, you know, it's really important to remember that George Bush launched, in addition to the war on terror, launched two specific wars, the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, both of which he failed to win.
Well, the first one was won by the Iranians, by the way.
The first one, we don't know who's going to win yet.
Well, I'd bet on the Iranians, frankly.
Okay. You can bet on the Iranians. You know, we forget that our enemies have their own dysfunctions.
Well, we can only hope. But, I mean, the point about, I think, there is a sort of zombie presidency here, because still a lot of these concepts are still out there. You've dealt with them in a way, I think, that is absolutely brilliant in this thriller that you've written, Salvation Army, in which the born-again Christian privatized faith is shaken to the core when he takes the case of a Muslim student suspected of killing his atheist professor. Now, the first of all, you're dealing with the two subjects that are verboten in polite conversation in this country, politics and religion.
Yeah, well, they're the most interesting topics, and they're the places where you find the most dead bodies. And that's why I constantly am choosing them. You know, we all woke up one morning early in the 21st century, and it was like we were having a collective bad acid flashback to the 12th century, with Islamic militants ready to martyr themselves just so they could kill infidels, and the leader of the West claiming that he was taking orders from God to invade various countries, and initially at least, and publicly calling his war a crusade. You know, and just like the war to take Jerusalem back under the 12th century popes. And I found this a remarkable series of events. And I also found that nobody was seriously exploring it. Why would people kill and die for what, to an outsider, is clearly fiction? I mean, Looney Tune fiction. And yet, you know, people routinely kill and die for it. They make tons of money from it. And there were no serious answers as to why this product has such sustaining power and why it was making a comeback. Now, so I said, okay, if I want to investigate this and make a living while I'm doing it, I have to do it in the form of a novel.
So do you think, though, that I mean, I get some people, because I come from Australia, they sort of say, oh, yeah, you're descended from convicts, to which I say to Americans, well, you're descended from religious fanatics. I mean, is there a Manichaeanism in our DNA? Because remember, we had, for all those decades, the convenient enemy, the Soviets, who were absolutely tailor-made as the enemy. And then that all went away, and there was a period of confusion where a bunch of people in camouflage bumped into each other in the woods looking for enemies and black helicopters and chips placed in their backsides. And then along comes Islamic terrorism, and now the legislature in Kansas has passing laws against Sharia law, which, frankly, is nowhere on the horizon.
Yeah, Manichaeism, which is, I guess, a name for philosophical binaryism.
Right, where your God is defined by the devil.
The truth is that is a real fundamental of human psychology and of necessity. That is to say, the purpose of our minds is to make decisions. And all decisions are essentially yes, no. Yes, it's food. No, it's not. You're a friend. You're an enemy. I'm going to fight. I'm going to flee. I'm going to have sex. I'm going to leave it alone. I'm going to jump off the cliff. I'm going to stay on the edge. So, you know, that kind of thinking is in our structure. Now, the question is, when is it functional thinking? When is it dysfunctional thinking? How do we moderate it? So there's a certain place, clearly, that religion is functional. It makes people feel better. In a lot of people, it improves their health. It's an organizing principle where people can get together and socialize and support each other. It's one of the foundations of our civil rights movement. It has lots of utilitarian qualities. On the other hand, the exact same philosophy and theology can be used for slavery, oppression, in support of horrific regimes, as an excuse to commit mass murder, as a reason to kill yourself. So it's not religion per se that's the issue. It's not Manichaean thinking per se that's the issue. It's where do they come from in our biology and in our social history, and how do we take what's good in them and moderate what's bad in them? Because we can no more eradicate religion than you can eradicate alcohol and marijuana use.
Well, but Larry Beinhart, I suppose it, in a way, it gets down to the terrible fact that that hate is easier than love and death is easier than life.
Is it?
Well, I think for a lot of people it is.
Well, for some people it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, you'd like to be able to say, well, if that's the way you feel about it, you know, why don't you find some like-minded people who feel about it that way and leave the rest of us alone?
Good luck. Well, I mean,
I mean, wouldn't it be great if you could take, say, Osama bin, well, he's dead now, but, you know, Osama bin Laden's 34th number two guy, whichever one we haven't killed yet, right, and put him in an arena with George Bush and Dick Cheney and let them bash it out?
Well, I'd buy tickets to that event.
Yeah, wouldn't you?
Let me remind the audience, if I may, that I'm speaking with Larry Beinhart, the author of Salvation Boulevard, just out in paperback. There's also a movie of it out at the moment in theaters. This is a wonderful religious thriller, if you will, a religious legal thriller, in which Ahmed Nazami, a Muslim scholarship student at the university, confesses under duress to the murder of Nathaniel McLeod, an atheist philosophy professor, and a PI, Carl Van Wagener, a born-again Christian, agrees to help Manny Goldfarb, a celebrated Jewish defense lawyer, prove that Nazami's innocence. And Van Wagener is a member member of the charismatic church of this charismatic pastor, Paul Plowright's Cathedral of the Third Millennium. They're all suddenly and soon on the trail of a missing manuscript, which MacLeod wrote disproving God's existence. I mean, frankly, I noticed Vince Bugliosi gave you a blurb. I interviewed him recently. It sounds a bit like Vince, right? He's written The Divinity of Doubt. He's written that very manuscript, which I guess in your case is a MacGuffin, right?
No, I mean, it is and it isn't. In order to have that character, I had to write, you know, figure out what he would have said. I've never actually, you know, I was raised on George Bernard Shaw. And whenever he had a character who wrote a book, only happened a couple of times, he then attached at the end of the play the book the character wrote.
Hmm.
So the professor's book kind of exists. It's mostly in my computer, and there's enough fragments of it in the novel that you know what he's saying.
Right. Well, that's a tough thing to do, though. And you have to write a philosophical tract.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, to me, there's a job, and the job is to write an entertaining page-turning book.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there are moments when that is a great deal of fun. But what gets my juices flowing and what makes me want to write the book is the opportunity to explore ideas that I don't find the answer to elsewhere. Wag the Dog. I was watching Gulf War I on television, and I made a joke, this is a made-for-TV movie. And nobody quite laughed, so I made the joke bigger. But it was a chance to explore the notion of creating war, or in the case of the movie, the illusion of war, for the purposes of domestic political propaganda, where people create wars in order to be elected or get reelected. And once you start looking at that, you discover in our recent history, certainly, it's happened a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's actually, ironically, it didn't happen for the prosecutor of the first war, Bush Sr. He got huge ratings and then shortly thereafter was defeated.
Yeah, he mistimed it.
But the other guy, the junior, very, very clearly went to war for political gain.
Really? So did Bush 1. Senator Bush won.
Yeah.
I mean, they watched Thatcher, and Thatcher was dead in the water, you should pardon the expression, until she had the Falklands War. And suddenly her political life was revived, and she went on to be the longest-serving British prime minister in modern history because she had a good war. And then Reagan decided to try it out, you know, but it was after Bush one saw Maggie Thatcher in the Falklands,
mm-hmm,
that they decided to have the Iraq War. But if you go back further, you have Lyndon Johnson unable to get out of Vietnam. Because he's certain that if he does, he will lose re-election, or Hubert Humphrey will lose the election, which he does. And then Nixon comes into office, and it looks like, I haven't written about this for a long time, but Johnson is negotiating and the war in Vietnam, and Nixon reaches out and contacts the South Vietnamese and tells them, if you don't go along with this and you keep the war going, I'll get you a better deal afterward.
Well, specifically there, Larry, that was, I believe, Henry Kissinger,
right,
using the good offices of Madam Chiang Kai-shek.
So you have the notion of people having wars. And
by the way, what you just described is treason. It is treason.
Treason. It's mass murder.
It's no, but it's treason for a government in waiting to sabotage a government in office and
right.
sabotage
and
American
foreign policy. And it's just as provable as you can get without having a trial that that's what happened. There doesn't seem to be much dispute about it. And then when once Nixon's in office, they have the terms for the Paris peace talks, and then they decide, you know what, we can't do it until after we're reelected.
Well, he already got a trial at Watergate. We can't try him now. We've run out of time, Larry. I thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thanks
Ian.
A lot.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Larry Beinhart, the award-winning novelist and author of Salvation Boulevard, just out in paperback. The movie's also out now. He's also did Wag the Dog, which was made into a classic film. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we started out with Lawrence Jacobs, who's the director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota. And he has an article at CNN.com where he talks about who's winning the debt debate. And he pretty clearly comes out on the side of the president and, I suppose, by extension, the Democrats. He does believe that the polling indicates that the general public are starting to get quite alarmed at the reckless behavior of the Republicans, the extortion. But I pointed out to him that this is not the way the press presents it. It's presented in this equal and balanced way. When in fact it's just one side that's threatening to wreck the economy and holding hostage the threat of economic collapse unless their political demands are met. Frankly, that is something that, Paul Krugman wrote about, and I talked to the second person we talked, actually the third person, but the second person we talked to was Sam Pizzagatti, who's the editor of the online newsletter Too Much. He also has an article at alternate.org, Plutocracy, If Corporations and the Rich Paid 1960s-Level Taxes, the Debt Would Vanish. He made that case, but also made the case that the people that with the money now own the politics in this country, and that he ultimately believes that things are going to get so bad so quickly, and just looking at what's going on in the Republican House, he thinks that perhaps people will start getting more politically active and controlling their political lives and their political destiny, despite the fact that we're clearly in an era where the power of money is greater than the power of votes. Obviously, the way to turn that around is for more people to vote. I talked with John Hanrahan, former executive director of the Fund for Investigative Journalism. He's now working with the Nyman Watchdog. He's written an article, at least 1,400 arrests for anti-war dissent, but who's counting? Not the press. We talked about why the press is not covering dissent, how it's helping keep us in these wars, like in Afghanistan, for example. We got into the notion that maybe the press, because they like to be cynical, they like not to feel engaged in any way, that they sort of dismiss political activists as sort of irritating zealots. And the truth of the matter is that that reflects on their indifference to covering events. And, we just saw a kid jailed today for 2 years for essentially protesting global warming. And then we talked with the comedian Larry Beinhart. He wrote Wag the Dog, and he has which is a classic movie, and Salvation Boulevard now out, which deals with religious intolerance, a thriller about a born-again Christian privatized faith shaken to the core when he takes the case of a Muslim student suspected of killing his atheist professor. Quite a story, but one that's very much in the news today. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side.